A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, I'm Helen.
And I'm Stephen.
And this is the New Statesman podcast.
On this week's podcast,
we'll talk about student fees. What's the row really all about?
Then we discuss our favourite political dramas.
Is it the West Wing? Is it Scandal? Is it Yes Minister? Or is it none of the above?
It does feel like there's one big story for a given value of the word big.
And embrace it. Love story. It, Stephen. It's tuition fees. You know you want to talk about it, really. The Tories have made it of their big kind of, hey, so the Tories still exist as a party. That was an exciting revelation. They've been pumping out policy announcements like someone's got the handle stuck on their machine.
It's one of those things where the story itself is not interesting because it involves a incredibly literal
Well, so what he said was, right, he said to the New Musical Express, as I old-fashionedly call it, during the election campaign, I will deal with it, right, when people talked about historic student debt,
so
alongside a concrete manifesto pledge to end tuition fees, actually starting from the autumn, pretty much, or that they would get a rebate for people starting this autumn.
What he said in his interview with The Enemy was, and I'm going to paraphrase slightly, but I hope not, in a way that distorts the meaning either too fairly or too unfairly. Yeah, you know what I mean? He was asked, what about people who have already got tuition fee debt? And he was like, I'm aware of this problem. I don't have a solution to it. I think it's not fair to have like a weird generation which had to pay when the one before and after, didn't it? I don't know what the solution is because we've been caught on the hop by this election. We will deal with it. Since the election, Labour has said, well, it is an ambition to deal with this tuition fee policy.
And they found a couple of MPs who'd gone a bit further foolishly, like had sort of represented it in more concrete terms than it was said by Jeremy Corbyn, right, as well, which helped the Tory attack line.
Zod, I keep saying in the safe space of the podcast, and then I keep meeting terrifyingly impressive people who listen to it. But in the pseudo-safe space of the podcast.
Yeah, I can't see them, and I can't hear them when we're talking now, and that makes it feel safe.
It does feel that. Certainty that the tuition fee pledge is why Jeremy Corbyn did so well in the election is almost exactly linked with certainty that Jeremy Corbyn was not surging before the election.
Yeah, I think there's a really interesting thing as well, which is, I think, which will eventually presumably start to spook the Tories in that they're swinging these punches that then actually aren't connecting. I was on Week in Westminster at the weekend, and one of the things that Peter Oborne said, and yeah, I'm sure his Tory contacts are much better than mine, was that after the Corbyn speech after the terror attack, where he said, you know, there is a blowback, we have to link this to Western foreign policy, he said that he thought the Tories at that point were like, well, we've won this one then. And actually, it really didn't have the resonance and an impact with people that they thought it would. And I think we've seen that same dynamic with tuition fees, right? They thought this is pretty much a slam dunk.
So on the one hand, there's the kind of the politics behind the politics, which is that they have discovered having a grid again and a message, and they've got their sort of message discipline back where they all kind of do that Borg-like thing of going, students, now you see, and, you know, kind of they've got this attack. It's you know, they are successfully getting it out in their sort of friendly media, but they've also made enough noise and sort of everyone else has kind of had to respond or run something on it. But I think there is a big danger to them that a lot of them seem to believe it, right? You know, it's one thing to kind of inconvenience the government by like, ha ha, you've got an ambition for it. And it is going to be a bit of a pain for Labour because writing off or ameliorating some of the debt is actually quite expensive.
Well, it's also given the Tories an attack line every time Labour talk about a popular policy. So you kind of, everyone's talking about Labour's popular policy, you go, bang, but why aren't we talking about this then?
But I just think the problem is that most people, so the YouGov have polled asking people what they thought of the statement. Of course, in order to do the poll, they've had to show people the statement and go, look, what is your interpretation of this? We, of course, know in the nicest possible way to the enemy, a magazine I actually do make a conscious effort of, like, collecting whenever it's being given out at the station.
Yeah. It's not the great election decider.
But also just people don't read any piece or interview or magazine, even one they read only for politics pieces, with that sort of level of detail. Like, things like that don't cut through. So basically, we know that if you actively increase the salience of the issue, right, if you actively ask people to have an opinion on this quote, they kind of go, yeah, I think Jeremy Corbyn probably wasn't trying to have his cake and eat it. There's really no point. Tuition fees moves three groups of voters, one of whom is not really worth anything. People who believe very strongly in the principle of free education and universal service. That group of people, A, it's quite small, but also it's not worth anything to you because that group of people is voting for Jeremy Corbyn, right? They are immovable. Then there are parents of people who are paying tuition fees, who are worried about their children, right? They don't care about my tuition fee debt. Then you have people who are going through the system who are students who have not paid back, or people who are going into university who are worried about the fee group. Again, maybe those people, there's some evidence from the very unscientific metric of 18 to 21s who read Morning Call, then some of those people do think it's a bit unfair.
No shade, but how big can that sample size
be? Actually, there's a depressingly large number of people who are like,
okay,
oh,
if you are 18 to 21 and reading Morning Call, why are you awake at that? I mean, I know you send that pretty late, but you should not be awake at that time in the morning, people. Live your best life as a student.
But, you know, those people kind of feel a bit concerned about my tuition fees. But the bulk of people who are paying back the fees, they might go, yeah, in theory, I'm not into it. But they're either sort of pro it or they're anti it. But in both cases, when you ask them how much they actually care, it's behind.
It's not going to make you go, well, now I'm going to vote for the Tories.
It's behind something like,
love
so,
Jeremy,
you know,
Corbyn.
Like, what's something which is important that I care about that no one else does? I don't know, international development or electoral reform, right? It's at that level of salience, right?
But this is where I disagree with you, because where I think this issue is important is the clue it gives to what the Tory attack on Jeremy Corbyn for the first part of this parliament is going to be, which is an attack on his integrity, his attack on the idea that he's sui generis. You know, he's not a politician like the others. Yes, Nick Clegg might have lied to you on tuition fees, and yes, we might have lied to you on social care, but now look, Labour are lying to you about this, and like, he's just the same as the rest of us.
I'm now starting to notice Conservative MPs who I respect, staffers who I respect, random people on Twitter being retweeted in my feed, who genuinely, and then, you know, like commentators who seem to have become increasingly frothy since the election, who all genuinely seem to think that the tuition fee pledge did move voters. It's one thing to successfully, and in some ways, when you know, they've got effectively a whole new political team in Downing Street, it makes sense to roll out your new operation with an attack line you're not that wedded to, because it allows you to go, oh, so we've got proof of concept that we can launch a missile, right? And it's the same way you don't put your uranium in the first ICBM you send up, right? You do that later in your test flight. But I don't know why I chose to use that metaphor. But the difficulty is that
no one cares.
No, it's
if
not.
There's no uranium, presumably people are not.
Oh, no, the difficulty is if you launch the bomb and you go, oh yeah, we've hit something with our nuclear deterrent. I also think
this is a terrible metaphor. If you hit something with your test flight of your nuclear deterrent, it's no longer a nuclear deterrent. It's just an actual bomb.
But I think things. But if people, but it's important for people to remember that their test flight doesn't actually have a ballistic payload in it. And I think that there is a risk to the Conservatives, and they think that. I also think on the Europe thing, right? I'm certain that some people are going to turn around and go, wait, we've been had on Jeremy Corbyn and the EU thing. At least if you take an incredibly literal interpretation and just like ignore some of the words in the Enemy interview, at least you've sort of got a leg to semi-stand on. On the Europe stuff, Jeremy Corbyn is an explicit Eurosceptic, right? He voted against every European treaty. He said in 2015 he hadn't closed his mind to exit. He whipped Labour MPs in favour of voting for Article 50. And I think it's always important to remember that not looking silly is quite an important factor in why people make decisions. Now, yes, there are lots of people who, because they pick up on the fact that in terms of the wider reasons they're into the EU, you know, they get that Corbyn is their guy and then Theresa May was not their guy and then Tim Farron was not their guy, right? And although all of those things remain, that decision, I think, is slightly less daft than it seems, there'll be a group of people who will be angry with Corbyn for a stance that they kind of know they don't have a legitimate case to be angry with.
I thought you were going to say there was legitimate concerns there, which is kind of a good phrase to use in the circumstances, because exactly the point about Corbyn's line that he was talking about immigration, about this wholesale importation of workers has driven down conditions for existing workforces, is that, you know, it's a really good proof of what tribalism looks like in politics, which is that because he has people's trust on that issue, he can say the same things that that Ed Miliband was saying. And, you know, he hadn't put it on a mug, but he could put that on a mug, and it does exactly the same job, which is it's a signal to people who are worried about immigration that Labour's taking it seriously. But he's got enough goodwill that he's able to do that.
Yeah, and I think the other reason why the tuition fee thing doesn't work and is a bad approach, right, is that there is already a problem that voters, regardless of whether or not they, and actually you, so you ask people, do you think Jeremy Corbyn gets a lot of flack? And they kind of go yes. And then even if when you go, do you think then he deserves to be given a hard time, they go yes. They still think the attacks are unfair. And I kind of think every time that the Conservatives are attacking Jeremy Corbyn on some abstruse thing about fees where most people didn't think that, it's not a chip in the kind of Corbyn edifice. It's
blunting their own tool.
Another thing where people go like, oh, but they're always going on at him. And actually, to be honest, if I were the Tories, the attack line with the tuition fee pledge is not the, oh, he lied, because it's still an ambition. It's, they had one of the things they did very effectively is with their costings document. It meant that the fact that the Tories had not costed anything meant that it was very hard for the right to go, oh, are there more tax rises to come? Whereas with the Eds, we all knew that Ed Balls and Ed Miliband wanted more tax rises than they were talking about. So they looked continually shifty, right? The prize surely here for the Conservatives to go, so the commitment you'll owe to is 11 billion, but we know that you want to do something about the 100 billion, therefore some other taxes will have to go up. That is a more intelligent attack line, and it also has the advantage that it is about something Jeremy actually said.
Well, if you're listening, Conservative Party spinners, Stephen is available for contract work at
reasonable rates.
At a low, low price.
Summertime and the living is easy.
Summertime and the reading is easy. In the magazine this week, we have a best political novels that have been nominated by some really great contributors, actually. I'm trying to remember what George Osborne's was, but I can't remember now. Oh, I think it was The Master and Margarita.
I like how you went to great contributors and then George Osborne.
I know what our podcast listeners like. No, we've got Mary Beard. We've got other people who are probably more on brand for The New Statesman. But it just happened to be the one I was looking at before we came. And you'll hear from some of those contributors throughout the segment. But I want to quickly whip through. Let's not talk books, because, you know, who reads books anymore, Stephen? We're millennials. Tell me your favourite TV show about politics.
Can I say Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy? Does that count?
Only if you want me to give you some serious side eye, because that's also Jason's pick for his favourite political book in the thing. So you're being very crawly there to the boss.
I've read Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy at least once every year since like 2005, because I'm just that cool, and every year I gain something new from it. It's really good, and the TV show is, it's not better, but it's as good. Alec Guinness is George Smiley. It's a brilliant performance. I strongly urge, you know, if you haven't seen it, to watch it. You might worry that it's a bit confusing. It's one of those things where it feels confusing, but actually if you just like let it flow, you understand it, as it were. It's weirdly one of those things which is more confusing if you try and puzzle it out yourself. But if you just let the the sort of brilliant acting and the craft of it. So, you know,
sorry, you just made me think, do you know what's a terrible film? And I know that lots of people that I know mysteriously really like this film. Bridge of Spies. God, that was a terrible film. Have you seen that?
No, but I have a theory that...
It's Tom Hanks and Mark Rylance, which you would think, bingo, brilliant, yeah. Steven Spielberg directing. And it's just nothing happens. I mean, the bit where Mark Rylance stands on the bridge is the highlight.
Well, so I have a theory, and obviously there's a problem in the lobby, then, you know, you don't want to look stupid, right? If I go to a press conference and I decide something is the line and someone, like, the spectator decides something, well, yeah, like, Labour list decides something different, then I may look foolish in you and Jason's eyes. But if we both collude and we decide then what the line is before, we can't get in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
I have a theory, and this happens with films which are boring or overly complex, in that no one wants to be the only film reviewer to be like, I didn't get it. Right, like Lincoln, right? Lincoln, a hugely boring political...
I tried watching that on the plane, which was a bad idea anyway, but I just had 2 minutes of Daniel Day-Lewis and his absurd Beau Selector chin sitting there, like, looking gloomy in the rain, and I thought,
but
I'm out. I'm
no
going
to
go watch the
one
where
only reviewer to
Bear
go,
Grylls, like, takes Mel B into the wilderness. That's
yeah,
what I'm here for.
Yeah, no one wants to be the only reviewer to go, Lincoln, pretty dull. So, yeah, there's safety in numbers. So I also think Birdman is another example
the
of
the worst
this.
Film ever made. Yeah, yeah. Oh, I hate that film so much. I hate everyone associated with it. If they all died, I wouldn't be sorry.
Well, yeah, so what's your favourite political...
Oh, I can't believe you've mentioned Birdman. I find the... that bloody music that runs all the way through the... Yeah, sorry.
But no one wants to... Everyone wants to go, oh, the single camera shot. Because that opinion, no one's going to go, oh, do you remember when so-and-so reviewed Birdman and went, to be honest, I was baffled. Like, you know, you don't want to be that guy.
Yeah, the highlight was Edward Norton in his pants, and that wasn't even that much of a highlight. So he got to the end and my husband started shouting, jump, jump! And I thought, yeah, I'm kind of with you here. But Victoria... This is film review. This is my new segment I like to call secondhand film reviews. He says it's great, which is actually genuinely filmed in one cut, right? Rather than being made to look like it. I'm going to nominate the first House of Cards, the original TV show, filmed in like creaky square-o-vision and on like best watched from the kind of VHS format, rather than the Kevin Spacey reboot. Just because I think it's...
Because it's good?
Yeah, A, because it's actually good and doesn't mistake stylishly, you know, drawing your finger around the rim of a glass for tension, and also because it is as a period piece, it's really fascinating because it feels very major era, a time when actually when sex scandals, I've written about this in my column this week, sex scandals were still a thing. We now, sex scandals really don't dent you. It's all money is the thing that we really find scandalous now, and the misappropriation of money, and just how blokey the House of Commons is, which I know it's, you know, it's not unblokey now, but it does really, that sort of sweltering public school atmosphere that you've got is really well evoked by it, I think.
Yeah, it's really good. My anti-nomination is the modern one, where, I mean, so the one problem the British version has is whenever Ian Richardson's not on screen, you'll kind of continue like, oh, I want him to come back. Why hasn't he come back?
Yeah.
But he's on screen for maybe 85% of it, whereas, you know, like, whenever Kevin Spacey's not on screen, yeah, I don't care about Claire Underwood's, the Clean Water Initiative or whatever it was. Her whole... And I feel like whenever I kind of flick onto it or hear something about it, her aims have become even more implausible and boring and taking up... Like, last time I checked, apparently she was angry because he was trying to focus on getting re-elected and she wanted him to appoint her to be his UN ambassador, which is like, when this is like, this doesn't make sense as a conflict, because if he's not re-elected...
He can't appoint you as UN ambassador.
Yeah,
anyway,
he can't appoint you as UN ambassador. And like...
Also, the trouble is that the Trump era has made implausible TV plots now too implausible. You should be like, what kind of crazy president would be able to appoint his wife to the UN? And then you go, yeah, that's a total... It's only because Melania literally cannot be bothered to travel to the UN that that's not happened already. I would like to nominate Scandal, but only the first three series until her dad turns up and it goes... literally too bonkers. It's one of those kind of classic TV series where you have a first series that's quite tight and quite episodic, you know, you have Mystery of the Week, and then it gets carried away, a bit like kind of the Russell T. Davis era of Doctor Who happened. Then the series arc begins to really take over, and actually you lose the kind of fun CSI, kind of a different case every week aspect of it, and it becomes much more soapy. Nonetheless, the Shonda Rhimes dialogue, I love.
So I don't actually watch Scandal myself, but my partner often has it on when I'm
secondhand working. TV reviews. What does Felicity think about Scandal?
She really likes it, but I also quite enjoy the kind of. I think its soapiness to me seems like part of my vicarious appeal is when I'm sitting there, you know, like writing my cookery column for The Guardian while she's watching Scandal, is when you hear lines like, "Well, we should never have replaced the president with a monkey," and it. I just think it's
appeal is... We're gladiators in suits. That's my favourite one.
Its appeal is, to me, it's soap opera-ness, which also actually is going to drive my pick, which it kind of has a complex feeling about it, like The West Wing, right? It's not The West Wing's fault that people took a brilliant, high-class... ultimately a high-class soap opera and decided it was a manual for how to, like, revive the centre-left in Britain,
this
right?
is a funny time
it's
because...
It's not The West Wing's fault.
We're talking the day after John McCain came back from his treatment for his brain cancer to make a speech in the Senate, and everyone was like, wouldn't it be amazing if John McCain came back from his treatment from his brain cancer to save healthcare? And instead what happened is John McCain came back from treatment for his brain cancer to vote, and an incredibly narrow vote that had to be broken on a tie by the vice president in favour of opening a discussion to take away millions of people's healthcare.
He didn't even vote.
It was like the anti-Sorkin. Then he gave a speech, like he gave a really Sorkin-y speech about, like, we've just got to get back to democracy. And you were like, this is bad. This is your fault, Aaron Sorkin, but because there is a weird, bizarro world version of you out there.
Yeah, I mean, I think the weird thing about the McCain... speech to drift, as we sometimes do, is then there were two votes. There was the procedural vote to start voting, and there was the other one which kind of defeated it for now, although obviously it will be back. He didn't vote the right way on either of them, right? And the thing is, actually, if you want to tell a story of what is wrong with the modern Republican Party, it's people like John McCain. If John McCain was as principled as he pretends to be in speeches, you know, and he was like, oh, you know, actually, he is an American citizen. If he actually cared about any of that stuff, he'd be François Fillon. I never thought I'd ever say something nice about François Fillon, but...
What do you mean by that?
So,
and Fillon... that he'd have a terrible financial scandal and would eventually lose to Emmanuel Macron?
No, because Fillon, right, faced with a choice between someone to his left who he didn't share
the
politics
of... the lack of Le Pen endorsement?
And okay, yes, there are other reasons why the populist right has not been able to win elsewhere other than the US, not least the fact that it could only win in the US thanks to the Electoral College. But another part of it is the behaviour of the centre-right towards
the far-right, right? I was thinking about this in relation to, you know, Miley Yiannopoulos, who I know you've previously argued should be deprived of the oxygen of publicity, but on this one occasion, really interesting, his book... you know, this amazing book that was cancelled by Simon Schuster appears to have sold about, you know, 12 copies. I mean, I'm sure it's sold like 1,000 copies or something.
It's
like
actually
that.
Sold like 157
In Britain, it's really, really low, right? And what that shows is actually when you're deprived of all, you know, the guy was banned from Twitter for trolling the Ghostbusters actor Leslie Jones. He had his book contract dropped after making some very, very borderline remarks about I don't know how we phrase this with the legal confines of the podcast, elder gentleman having sex with younger gentleman. And then, you know, actually what happens is it turns out without a huge edifice of stuff, his invitation to speak at the Republican conference was rescinded. You know, so without the centre-right indulging somebody like this, actually the actual fan base for them is really, really small.
Yeah, and, you know, the fact that people like McCain have sat there going, oh, it's awful, oh, we need to have more civility... I, of course, am voting for the guy saying, lock her up, lock her up.
Yeah.
You know, is actually their problem. I did think, weirdly, despite the fact that, you know, one of the other problems in American politics is that the American, I always feel weird using the word centre-left in an American context, but the American centre-left, such as it is, rewarding Republican moderates for going, oh, this is terrible, 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 and now I'm going to vote for it. Weirdly, despite the fact I don't think for a moment that they arrived at the correct strategy for the right reasons, I think it was probably a good thing and they had the bizarre clapping of the, oh, this ill man has come back, because otherwise it would have allowed the Republicans to unify behind, oh, he's a veteran, oh, they're not respecting this ill guy. But actually, yeah, John McCain is much more responsible, than I would say, than Trump, right? Trump quite clearly can't tell right from wrong. John McCain clearly can, because otherwise he wouldn't give these speeches in which he talked about doing the right thing. He just decides to do the wrong thing.
And that's the fault of the West Wing.
Yeah.
A lot can happen in 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
And now we're going to hear from some of the New Statesman magazine contributors who are in this week's print title, Run, Don't Walk, Unless You Require Assistance, in which case whatever mode of transport is the best for you, to the shops to buy one.
I'm Erica Wagner. I am a New Statesman contributing writer, and I am the author of Chief Engineer, The Man Who Built the Brooklyn Bridge, which is published by Bloomsbury. My summer choice for a political read is The Man in the High Castle by Philip K. Dick. Amazon's adaptation of The Man in the High Castle left me cold, and so there was nothing for it but to belatedly turn to the novel, which is its source. Dick's tale is set 15 years after the end of the Second World War. German and Japanese victory over the Allies was secured in 1948, and the United States is carved up between the two powers, with a neutral zone between them. But where Frank Spotnitz's admittedly atmospheric adaptation relies on the tropes of the counterfactual thriller, Dick's original is a subtle and disturbing game that plays with reality itself. Its characters live in a world which is all too believable, especially in 2017. The Japanese and German overlords continue to vie for supremacy, and personal loyalties trump, pun intended, political process. The conquered can only escape their conquest through an act of imagination. And perhaps even that is impossible.
My name is Tom Holland, and my choice of book is Herman Brock's The Death of Virgil. The Death of Virgil has haunted me ever since I first read it. Begun in 1936 and finished as the Third Reich collapsed into ruin in 1945, it is the profoundest fictional meditation on the relationship between politics and art ever written. Inspired by the legend that Virgil, shortly before he died, requested that the Aeneid be destroyed, it casts Rome's greatest poet as a man haunted by the ambivalences and responsibilities of artists in an age of autocracy. Augustus, whose last meeting with Virgil provides the novel with its central encounter, has never been more charismatically or more terrifyingly rendered.
I'm Robert McFarlane, and the novel I've chosen is This Blinding Absence of Light, a 2001 novel by the Moroccan writer Taha Ben Jeloun, first published in French with the title Cette aveuglante absence de lumière. This novel, which is translated by Linda Coverdale, recounts the experiences of a prisoner or prisoners in Morocco's notorious Tazmamart jail, a specialist incarceration facility set deep in the desert that's designed to destroy body and spirit by increments. The story that unfolds in the book is one in which determined cruelty and determined hope keep company, and in which the only possible counter to brutality is something close to mysticism. The voice that speaks to us offers a scoured and a scarred testimony, which is very hard to hear, but also impossible to abandon. And the novel as a whole seems to me a terrible and triumphant vindication of the novel as a political form, proof of what prose fiction can still achieve, that even campaigning journalism, reportage, or film still cannot.
You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Stephen Bush, and my colleague Helen Lewis. Our music is by the Underscore Orchestra and is licensed under Creative Commons. We're produced by India Bork and mixed by James Shield. As there's no magazine for next week, buy two this week. Or better yet, subscribe.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Looking for inspiring stories? Listen to the EY Leading Into Tomorrow podcast. It features compelling stories from leaders across government and the public sector who've transformed their organizations and services. From the impact of grants to how digital innovation is reshaping affordable childcare, you'll get actionable insights and ideas that can be used around the world. Download Leading Into Tomorrow by EY wherever you get your podcasts.